Welcome back to another episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature, Captain America the First Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts, just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And I'm Hal Bryan from the home of the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
And I'm Brian Fees. I'm a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader. And I'm honored to introduce our special guest today. He's Judd Winnick. Judd is a cartoonist and writer whose resume is so long, I can only skim it. He was a pioneer in the field of graphic medicine, which means a lot to me with his graphic novel, Pedro and Me, about his relationship with the late AIDS activist Pedro Zamora. He has acclaimed runs as a writer of superhero comic books, including Green Lantern, Green Arrow, and Batman. He created the Cartoon Network series Juniper Lee and is the author and artist of the best-selling graphic novel series for kids titled Hi-Lo, published by Random House. And he recently wrote and drew a short story for an anthology that we will talk about because it is very relevant to this minute of the Captain America movie. Welcome, Judd.
Thank you. Thank you, Brian. Thank you, Jim. Thank you, Hal. Thank you for having me here. And a heck of an introduction. We can only go down from there. That's
well,
great.
Let me know later if I missed anything. Hal, what's happening in this minute of Captain America, the First Avenger?
Well, Brian, we're in minute 9, ineligible on your asthma alone. And here's the synopsis. In the shattered church, Johann Schmidt raises his pistol and shoots the church keeper, who collapses lifelessly. The scene shifts to an Army enlistment center in New York City, 1942. Steve Rogers, small and frail, sits among a crowd of military applicants clutching a newspaper. He scans an article, his brow furrowing. Boy, a lot of guys getting killed over there, he mutters to himself. An examiner's voice cuts through the room. O'Connell, Michael, Kaminsky, Henry, the examiner continues. A recruit nearby leans toward Steve. It kind of makes you think twice about enlisting, huh? Steve stands, heading toward the examiner, his voice firm. Nope. The examiner flips through Steve's file, thick with medical conditions. Rogers, he says, eyeing the pages. What did your father die of? Mustard gas, Steve answers. He was in the 107th Infantry. I was hoping I could be assigned. Your mother, the examiner presses. She was a nurse in a TB ward, Steve says. Got hit. Couldn't shake it. The examiner shakes his head. Sorry, son. Look, just give me a chance, Steve pleads. You'd be ineligible on your asthma alone, the examiner says.
That was lovely, Hal.
Well, yes, sir.
I want to buy that audiobook.
Why, thank you. I mean, I went to Juilliard for crying out loud.
So I wanted to open our talk with Judd. This is a particularly apt minute to have Judd because he and I recently both wrote and drew stories for an anthology called Marvel Super Stories 2 Amazing Adventures, which features 15 stories for young readers by cartoonists who don't normally draw superhero stories. So I'd love to start by talking about your story. Tell us about your Captain America story, Judd.
Yeah, Marvel came to me actually. They gave me Captain America to come up with a story. It's like, okay. And it's only 6 pages and it's almost silent. And to be honest, it spins more out of this movie than actually the Marvel comics, which is the note I kind of got from them. They're pretty notes heavy over at Marvel, and they had to redirect me a little bit. The way I was thinking about it, I got to tell you guys, the kids who are buying the book are probably more familiar with the movie than they are the, 75 years of Captain America comics.
Absolutely.
And it's a very simple story of Captain America's tuning up his motorcycle. And again, silent story. Bucky comes in tells him through like emoji that basically like, hey, remember this guy? It's a picture of a redheaded guy. Like it's just his head. And Steve goes, yeah. It's like, oh, he's in the hospital. And Steve kind of gives a grimace and then takes off on his motorcycle. And then we see in flashback that through the ages, this guy was a bully. And the story is called Hey Buddy Boy. And that's the only dialogue is over and over again. This bully sees Steve when he's a kid, says, Hey Buddy Boy, kicks crap out of him, sees him a little bit older when they're like teenagers, Hey Buddy Boy, kicks the crap out of him. Even sees him in basic training before Steve becomes Captain America, beats crap out of him. And then Steve as Captain America is marching through the hospital and it seems like Steve's got to give him a piece of his mind. And we go in there and we see this frail old man. And that's who the bully is now. And Steve looks at him and sees how old he is. And then just sits down next to him, pulls up a chair and says, "Hey, buddy boy," with a little smile on his face. And it's just a little story about forgiveness and about redemption. And in discussing a silent story like this is a little bit like trying to describe tap dancing. It made me very uncomfortable.
But you did great. Yeah. It's a sweet story. And the final epigraph of it is, you quote Gandhi, "The weak can never forgive. Forgiveness is the attribute of the strong." You know, I don't know if I could forgive my childhood bullies, no matter how old and frail they got. Is that why I am not worthy to be to be Captain America?
I don't know. I think you're putting the cart behind the horse there. If you were Steve Rogers in Captain America, then you might be more forgiving. Let's, you know, go the other way on it. Like little Steve, by the time he, you know, got to be older, could be pretty pissed off. You know, might not have, you know, I mean, by the time if Steven stayed small and like, you know, grew up in Brooklyn, I don't know. eventually life might have like beaten him up enough. We don't know.
I think, you know, one thing I love about your story is it makes a point that the movie also makes, which is Steve Rogers had everything he needed to be Captain America except the muscles.
Right.
You know, he was already that guy.
Yeah, it's what really makes it just, it's one of my favorite Marvel movies for that reason. It captures everything so well and really defines the character. And Steve Rogers, like the character they illustrate so well in this movie, carries all the way through to Endgame. It just really, you know, he is the bedrock of the Marvel universe in so many ways. And yeah, that little tiny bit, I do love that too, that, you know, the goodness that's in Steve, the honesty that's in Steve, the, you know, the bravery that's in Steve, it's all right there. It's all right there from right the beginning, you know, and that's what Peggy Carter falls in love with.
Yeah,
you know,
that's right.
Little Steve. That's the picture she has. The picture she has is little skinny Steve, not like big, handsome Captain America. It's just so right on. It's just so right on.
Absolutely. You know, Jed, when first talking about your story, you would talk about these things being short and being six pages. First thing that flashes into my head is the challenge of telling a meaningful story in six pages and then following it up with basically silent, with just the reuse of that dialogue. All I'm thinking of is somebody like Will Eisner at his peak, and that the challenge of telling a story so sparingly, and it's absolutely remarkable.
Oh, well, thanks. I mean, I dug this hole for myself that I have my own graphic novel series, and it's very, very chatty. In this one, I wanted to do something a little bit different and say, could I actually do one like that? And Eisner was someone I'd look towards, you know, or like, you know, or Wally Wood or any of them who like really just delivered the goods, just based on the art and the tone and the tenor of it. And yeah, when you're given, like, short stories are way harder than in many cases trying to do something long form where you get to meander a little bit. I mean, frankly, and to be probably too much information and probably talking out of school, Marvel gave me so many notes out of the gate. I actually told them, like, I'm not sure this is going to work. And, you know, it's like, and I don't know if I necessarily have another story in me, guys. So thanks. it's like, you know, it's like I managed to nail this one. And I was pretty happy with it. It's like, and they came back and I just realized that they're just kind of like, they're kind of notes heavy and very into the minutia. And we talked about like, oh, no. Okay. I can fix these things. Okay. But yeah, I knew one like, no, I did my 6-page silent story and that's all I got. I don't have another idea. I don't have another 6-pager in me, guys. I'm sorry.
That was my experience as well. I did an Avengers story for the same book. And
it was a great story, too.
Thank you so much. It features the Beast and Wonder Man and with a cameo from the Vision. But it was exactly the same thing. My first draft was too wordy, too long, too adult. And I put too much detail in the drawings. Mm-hmm. And I had to go back and redo the whole thing from scratch. I cut the dialogue and all the words in half, which always makes things tighter and better. Yeah. I had to unadult it just a little bit, but it really, for me, was if Marvel had come to me when I was 18 years old and said, "Brian, we've got 6 pages in the back of the book. Could you do a story for us?" This is the story I would have done. you know, something very much like that. It's a day, a slice in the life, which is a slice of a day in the life, which is what Marvel's always done best. You know, Spider-Man trying to wash his outfit in a laundromat or something. It's one of those, to me, in my mind, a classic Marvel story, and yours is as well. It's just a beautiful little almost poem what you did. And it's my second favorite story in the book, and mine is not the first. So.
Brian, I really enjoyed your story, and you got so much in 6 pages. The fact you got 3 characters,
thanks so much,
bouncing off one another. Oh, that was a lot. That was you know, that was rather Herculean. It was really impressive.
I appreciate it. Thank you. It means a lot coming from you. Appreciate it.
Oh, thank you.
I was wondering in your creative process, Jed, when you're sitting there and you're looking at a blank screen or a blank piece of paper and things like that, and you've got do you draw the 6 boxes and then just start staring at it, or where's the acorn that the oak tree comes out of?
Oh, heavens no. I plant the oak trees several months in advance and let it grow and don't even get out there. I mean, you know, putting all the metaphors aside, yeah. I try and walk around with the stories for, I mean, I don't wait for the muse to hit. But I have worked out a lot already in my head. So by the time that I'm actually getting down to business, I've worked out a lot already. I mean, you know, an example being is that I'm inking my next book right now. And so now that like a lot of the heavy lifting of the creative writing process, the storytelling process, making stuff up, I don't have to make up any more stuff. Now I've started thinking about the next book. I had like some half-baked ideas, and now I'm starting to put those ideas together. Now I'm really trying to cook it all up. I don't ever want to sit down and look at a blank page and like, okay, what's next? Like, no. I want to be able to like, I'm ready to get in the car and have a pretty good idea where we're going to drive by the time we get there. It's again, I often push back on anybody, young and old, who ask questions about stories. Like, don't wait for the muse to hit, you know, don't like just sit around and whatnot. But at the same time, don't come to it completely unprepared. Have an idea what you're going to do before you get started, because that's where writer's block happens. That's where quitting happens. You know, you gotta know what you're getting into. You gotta know what the story is. You gotta know what that path is. So I work a lot of it out ahead of time before I even get there. Like, again, like the 6-page story we're talking about, Captain America, you know, the idea hit me in the shower, you know, probably.
I'm, you start drawing things with your finger on the wall going, oh, this and this. Yeah.
Basically. Yeah. You know, it's like, it's like, and by the time I'm actually doing it, it's like, yeah, yeah. Okay. No, I think I know what I'm doing now. I think I know what I'm doing now. So, you know, get it done ahead of time as much as you can.
Terrific. We talked a little bit about, you know, character development and craft and that kind of thing. I'm curious. You know, writers love characters with flaws, a character who's arrogant or vain or headstrong or inexperienced, or it gives a writer something to sink their teeth into. Talk about the challenge of writing characters like Steve Rogers, or I suppose Superman, who have no flaws. What do you do with someone who is literally as good as you can get?
Well, I guess in those cases, it's always about the obstacles. I mean, it's one of the reasons why, I mean, you hear a lot of, you know, some of the hate nerds who are out there talking about how, you know, Superman's, is an impossible character to do a story about. You know, we just saw a terrific movie that managed, they cracked the code again. Steve Rogers and Captain America cracked the code again. They're hard because their flaws are not necessarily coming from them per se, but it's the situations around them. And I'm over talking it. With Steve, what does he come up against is that he has a code and a path, and he knows what he needs to do and who he is. And these obstacles around him, they're just doing wrong. There's a right way and there's a wrong way. And he doesn't necessarily see the grays. I think it's a similarity between Superman and Captain America. You know, they don't see the grays. And in case of Steve Rogers, when we get to Winter Soldier and Hydra pops up, like, oh my God, there's gray. Yeah. You know, he's got to turn on his government. I mean, and in that case, he knows. It's like, no. But in this case, they're wrong. It's like, no, but for the greater good, like, screw greater good. There's right and there's wrong, and this is wrong. And with them, it's about finding the obstacles. You know, what's going to get in their way? And, you know, they're not willing to give up on their morality. They're not willing to, find those changes in themselves. You know, they're, so that can be an obstacle, you know, like, you know, we could cheat. We could do it this way. I could lie. I could go about this way. They're not going to, it's just not in them. Yeah. They're harder. It's flawed characters are easy because they can just be hypocritical. I wrote so many hypocritical characters. For me, that was just a blast. You know, say one thing, do another. Breezy. Just hop right in there and do it.
With flawless characters, you can't attack them directly because they're just going to sit there and punch. But it's the threat to them are the people that they care about. So, I mean, you know, you've got, you know, with Steve, you've got Peggy, with Superman, you've got Lois Lane, you've got all these issues that people that they care about are in danger. And then, like you said, they have to do the right thing, but the right thing might involve them doing something wrong. And how do they work their way out of a situation where they can't do wrong? They can't, you know, Superman can't kill, at least comic book Superman can't kill, apparently.
Right. Yeah. How do you throw that needle? How do you get them there? I mean, that's the thing. That's about the storytelling. I mean, that's also what makes them rich characters. I mean, Stephen King has said more than a couple of times that, you know, plots are for suckers. You know, anybody can come up with a plot. And there's a lot of truth in that, that it's more about the characters. Once you've established a really good character, locking them into any sort of A to B to C story is not really the challenge. It's how they thrive and how they interact and how you make like a compelling story within, you know, this plot that you've created. You look at this movie, not the biggest head scratcher as far as plot goes. It's kind of by the numbers. It's pretty much our classic Captain America story, but they just nail the characters so well. And it's just that they say, oh no, that's really Captain America. Oh, and they reinvented Bucky in a great way,
yeah.
You know, in a really great way. And the Red Skull is pretty much the Red Skull as we've seen for a gazillion years, but seeing him come to life in a way like, oh no, I buy it. Like, you know, it's like, it works. It's great. He's horrible. You know, it's again, like, stories are characters.
I think Chris Evans pulled off something that nobody had pulled off since Christopher Reeve, which was playing a good character that you care about and that can carry a movie like that, you know, a heart of gold and making it interesting. I just can't say enough good things about Chris Evans in all the Captain America movies.
Yeah, I believe my previous the are we allowed to talk about? You just told me the previous guest was on the minute here, so I assume Joe Johnson talked quite a bit about Chris Evans, and I believe did you all talk about that Chris Evans turned the role down maybe twice, and for everything that came true, I mean Chris Evans was worried that like if I play Captain America I'm going to be Captain America forever, and the truth is like yeah.
He's right.
Kind of.
Yeah.
And to our benefit, and I don't know necessarily his detriment. I think we're not nearly done with Chris Evans as far as the actor, creator, director that he wants to be and whatnot.
Well, and he was a terrific villain. I think that made him such a good villain in the Knives Out movie, you know, because he played against type, and I think it worked well.
Yeah. Yeah. No, yeah, I don't think we're done with him.
And he also got to redo his role as Johnny Storm in the Deadpool movie. So it's like, right. You know.
And apparently he loved that.
Yeah. Oh, I did too. And as a fan, I didn't, and usually I spend most of a movie like guessing what's happening next. You know, in that case, I was so delightfully knocked on my ass surprised. Yeah. When, and even like Deadpool's kind of teeing it up, like he's gonna say it. And they says flame on, and I slammed both my hands down on the armrest. I was so excited, like, it's such a great gag. They got me. That's so great. Oh, it was so great. I was so thrilled.
It's funny, isn't it, how much just the act of being surprised, you know, can make a story so valuable, because so much of what we see and sort of we're sort of fed over and over and over. It's like, this is fine, this is pleasant, but I always sort of know exactly what's going to happen next, and I could doze off and pick it up again later. So you're absolutely right when you see something like that. So here's Chris Evans with the yay Captain America, not quite.
Yeah,
and some of the other cameos in that film too, and giving all these sort of also ran, you know, Marvel adjacent heroes a chance to have another go at it. It was brilliant.
Yeah.
Oh, there's nothing better when you get pantsed, when you just don't see it coming at all, you know? And I don't even mean like some big twist or like, I don't even mean like the big ticket items. I don't mean your Sixth Sense or, Anakin Skywalker. I mean, just like little things, little things where like, you know, you're expecting just a zig or a zag and you get one and like, oh, it's like, you know, it's like among my friends, we just call it like that. Like that's the magic trick.
Yeah.
Like, you know, that's the thing you pull off. Like, oh, can you believe they did that? Like that was the magic trick. Like you didn't, you know, you expected this, like, or one we always say, like, that movie was way better than it had to be. Like it didn't have to, it would have been perfectly acceptable here, and they leveled it up and it was even so much better.
Yeah, the Galaxy Quest effect. You just kind of yes! Like, how did this happen so good? You know, why is that the best Star Trek movie? It's amazing. I think the thing that I always wonder about when you're in a great, franchise, I would imagine that, you know, erosion and just the slog of doing it again and again and again can be tiring. But and we've talked about this on other shows. Hal and I have talked about their Herman Munster, Fred Gwynne hated being Herman Munster. He could never get far away enough from being Herman Munster. But on the other end of that spectrum, Tony Bennett, who, you know, I left my heart in San Francisco, he sang that song every day from 1960 to the day he passed. Right. And people said, how do you do that every day? You're singing that same song and you got to come at it like it's new. And he said, you know, this is the song that people love me for. And this is what, you know, this is my relationship with the audience. And this is how, you know, I'll give it to them every day because that's what they want. And I want to give them what they want. So it's like, I know Chris Evans wanted to do other things in movies and he doesn't want to be Captain America forever, but it's like, I can't imagine how that would be. I can imagine that would be hard to walk away from when everybody thinks of you as you just did a fantastic Captain America.
I assume that he knows he makes people happy.
Yeah.
And I assume, because I mean, you haven't heard the stories of him like pushing back on anything. I mean, the top shelf example, there was a gazillion years ago, it was a profile in Rolling Stone, Paul McCartney. In this, like, I don't know, in the 70s, I think it's in the late 70s, maybe early 80s. The reporter was going around with him, was talking about that everywhere they went, they were in the pub, they were in public, and everywhere they went, people just lit up because it's like, oh my God, Paul McCartney. And Paul was very gracious and whatnot. And the reporter actually asked him, like, how does that feel? And Paul McCartney said, it feels great. Like, can't you imagine how great it feels that when people see you, they're instantly happy? He said, I can't imagine I would ever tire of it, which is the only answer that you really can give. You know,
it occurs to me, Judd, that you might have some particular insight on this, because I think you've published 11 high-low books. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. So you've got this successful series. Do you put out one a year, every other year?
Yes. One a year.
Yeah. One a year. I'm actually friends with Jeff Kinney, who does the same thing with Diary of a Wimpy Kid. And it can be a slog, but it seems to be a slog that he, and I presume you, are grateful to have to do. How do you've got your own franchise. Yeah. How do you handle franchise fatigue?
I don't have it yet, knock wood. I will say this. I spent 12 years writing superhero comics. So I did my 10,000 hours of writing action adventure stories for DC Comics and a little bit of Marvel. With that, and I always tell a story because Ed Brubaker and I were talking about it. It's Ed Brubaker who wrote superhero comics and now does a lot, you know, he's a big shot TV creator. He had talked about that one time he was in the writer's room of I forget what show, and they got kicked in the head on something and they had to redo a whole episode. And Ed Brubaker said that, like, said, well, so we got to change this episode. What if we take this character and we put them here and we move this to the back of in the third act of the episode, we move that entire middle thing while we move it to the next episode. And everybody in the room looked at it like, how did you just come up with that? He goes, oh, I wrote superhero comics. And with that, the thing is that, like, when you write superhero comics, that every month you'd come, someone would come to you and say, like, yeah, so you can't use Nightwing in that next arc of Batman. It's like, what? It's like, no, you can't use Nightwing. Like, why? It's like, well, one, he broke his leg, and two, he's going to be another dimension. It's like, I don't care. It's like, yeah, well, we're thinking maybe you could use Martian Manhunter. Like, I don't want to use Martian Manhunter. I want to use Dick Grayson. What are you guys, crazy? And but then you had to look at it. You had to fix it, and you had to chop it up and move forward. That said, now I don't have anybody telling me I can't do whatever I want. And with that, it's, I get to make up my own stories with my own characters. I do make the choice of an expression we use is like burning a lot of wood, meaning that like I'm not saving the wood for when I get cold. The stories move forward and I go for it. I'm not saving it. And, you know, as we've gotten into, I'm working on the 12th book, it's getting a little more complicated. And I recognize that, like, the stories are getting bigger. I've had to, like, we go to different worlds, and the characters, different characters have powers. So we're getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And we start out by a little boy falls out of the sky, turns out he can fly and shoot lasers out of his hands. There's two new best friends. They go on this adventure and giant robots are trying to destroy them. And then with every subsequent adventure, it gets bigger and bigger. We're getting pretty big now, 10 years in.
Are you seeing like a crisis on Infinite Earths in your in your future? For
I am, in the sense I'm seeing more of an end game sort of situation.
Oh, okay. Like
I'm doing a whole new series coming out in February called The Mighty, which is, what's fun is that it's about a 12-year-old girl named Miranda Luna who discovers one day she can turn into a 9-foot monster. And she does what any kid would do. She doesn't tell her parents and she fights crime. So it's a sort of a Spider-Man meets the Incredible Hulk sort of thing. But it's all also in the world of Hilo. So it's in the same world, same universe. And what's funny was I was telling on my last book tour, I was talking to some kids, like I throw up a slide of like, yeah, so there's got a new series coming out next year called The Mighty. And kids immediately got it. They said, oh, is The Mighty going to cross over with Hilo? It's like, yeah. Like, oh, the Marvel movies. All you kids understand crossovers.
You're building a multiverse.
No, hey, when I was a kid, you know, I mean, we can all speak to this. Like, there was nothing more exciting than like, oh my God, the Fantastic Four are going to cross over with the Avengers and yeah. Spider-Man's going to be in there too. And they're going to fight Galactus. Like, this is going to be the greatest issue ever. Now kids understand that and they've come to expect it. So with that, I'm branching out. I'm going to do a couple other series, a couple other characters, and we are going to build to like a larger kind of event thing where I can do a little less Hilo, a little more of the other characters. But, you know, I think you asked me a very simple question, Brian, about 20 minutes ago.
About this. It's all good.
No. So
Jim's got the edit button. No.
Yeah.
I think, Jed, you and I think we've talked about this, but you and I have a very similar background of being, you know, superhero comic book readers, also comic strip readers, just comics as far back as we recall. And to me, part of the charm and thrill, you're talking about those thrilling moments of watching a movie of early Marvel, this first Captain America movie, the first Avengers movie, the first Thor movie, is seeing scenes that seemed pulled right off the panel, just like, oh, that's a Jack Kirby drawing. Oh, that's a George Perez group thing. You know, yeah. you could just see them. And to me, I sat in the first Avengers movie just staring at the screen saying, my God, they're going to pull it off. They're going to do it. Because I couldn't imagine how they were going to do it. And they did it. Same thing with this Captain America movie. Captain America, the First Avenger is it's not a point for point retelling of the comic book origin, but it's in its own way. It's beautiful. It's clean. It's self-contained. It's just a really nice piece of storytelling, I think.
Yeah. I also went into it. I mean, I thought about it for years as well. It's just like versus like a kid. And then they've been talking about it for so long. It's like hoping they would do it from World War II and then have him, you know, go into the big sleep and then wake up again. And they actually did it. Yeah. And they managed to capture just the vibe. And Joe Johnston was such a perfect director for it, like coming off the Rocketeer and kind of captured that wonderful nostalgic Norman Rockwell-ish vibe. You know, it has like a Raiders of the Lost Ark vibe. I mean, even from like in this minute, which is a really choice minute that we've got here, which gives us so much going on. When they even cut to the skyline And we can even talk specifically about it in a minute. When they cut to the skyline after Johann Schmidt, shoots Mr. Filch from Harry Potter. Yeah. The skyline choice is like, we look at New York City and it's actually not really how they usually show New York City during the 40s. It's actually like, it looks kind of shiny. It looks kind of pristine. It looks a little clean. It looks a hair futuristic, which is not really in the skyline. But when we get picked up later at the World's Fair, we understand we're in a different kind of reality. And it's just a little, again, I go back to Norman Rockwell. Has a Norman Rockwell-like quality, which is sort of the vibe and the feel and the, and like a recurring theme in the movie, which I managed to carry on through, which is Steve Rogers, which is who he is, right? He's a little bit Pollyanna, and it's beautiful in that way. It really is.
Yeah, and I mean, and this is the introduction when we go to New York. We're not in Manhattan, which is the typical when they're going back in time. It's usually, you know, let's go in downtown. We're in Midtown or something like that. We're in the little burb of Brooklyn.
Yeah,
and just getting the idea that this guy is the small town guy in the big city. And just, you know, it's he's a little guy from nowhere, as we'll get into later on, that, you know, he'll eventually say, I'm just a kid from Brooklyn. But, you know, he's an underdog among underdogs. I mean, he roots for the Dodgers instead of the Yankees. He's, you know,
right.
It's so much as underdog as you can get and still be in, you know, a major metropolitan city. And, you know, we instantly get, this is all exposition in the first, you know, in 40 seconds. It's like, my dad died in the 107th, and my mom got TB and died right after that. So I'm an orphan. I've got nobody. This is all I've got, and all I want to do is serve my country and fight bullies,
as my parents did. Like in 40 seconds, we get that his parents died serving. His parents died. His father died in the army. His mom died as a nurse serving, like boom, boom, like 45 seconds. We're done. And there's Steve, like stiff upper lip, you know, wow. You know, it's an amazing economy of exposition. And you just dig him. I mean, here he is, the expression in filmmaking, you know, saving the cat. You know, Steve saves like 9 or 10 different cats
in
the first, like 30 minutes of the movie. But this is the first one, you know, he's enlisting. He's there reading the newspapers. The guy says,
makes you think twice about enlisting, huh?
Yeah.
And Steve says, what does Steve say?
Yeah. Nope.
Judd, I need to go on record really quick. As soon as you said saving the cat, my cat just came and headbutted me and got my attention. So it was beautifully well-timed. I'm sorry the world out there can't see it. But
speak of cat and cat, she'll come. That's great.
But Hobson says hello, everybody.
Hobson, spectacular name for a cat, sir. Well done. Well done.
He came to us pre-named, but it was absolutely, absolutely perfect. So name for the character in Arthur.
Okay. I can go on and on and on. I judge people based on how they name their pets. And the fact that you got him named Hobson and knowing full well, like, no, we're going to keep Hobson. Like,
absolutely.
You know, fantastic. Fantastic.
Well, Judd, I've got to ask, when people are interested in finding your oeuvre, the literary equivalent of a discography, I guess library, where should they go to look for your works?
I laugh because I get to say this all the time. They can find the Hilo series wherever books are sold. Because I delight in the fact that my publisher is Random House. This little small independent publisher.
You may have heard of them.
I used to live next to the guy up in Mount Kisco that started the place. It was a surfer or something.
it's fun that, like, Random House, they are... This is something they say internally and externally. They are the largest publisher of books in the English language. Wow. So wherever books are sold, you can find Hilo, both in, and actually we've got the first seven are on audio, which was a blast as well.
Fun.
And I just bring it up because we're just talking about doing another audiobook. Anyway.
Did you record them or someone else?
I had nothing to do with them, and they moved so quickly I didn't even get the cameo I was supposed to get in there, which is fine. I got to adapt the scripts, which was interesting. because it's and Brian, you can attest to this and think about what a bit of a nightmare it was. Like, so you want me to take my graphic novel,
yeah,
and as I described the 6-page story that I just did, I had to do that as well and had to figure it out. So like, okay, so DJ is gonna be our narrator and he's got to talk through our action scenes. Like, this is just gonna be, so I wrote it and they actually did a spectacular job because they put an action sequence in. Anyway, but that's it. Buy the books, are good fun for everybody. So yes, wherever books are sold. And that's, it's a good time.
I do have to ask this question just for Brian's sake, because thanks to Jeff, Brian has a slight case of bus envy. Do you have a bus?
When you go on tour.
Do I have a bus?
Yes.
Oh, like an actual bus. Like a
yeah.
bus that you drive.
No.
Oh, heavens no. No. I mean, unless you count like Southwest Airlines as a bus, which depending, like you could argue that like is a little bit like a bus.
It's bus-like.
No, I am lucky enough. And also I do a tour. I will go out. I go local a lot. I go all around the Bay Area and just outside the Bay Area as much as I can. And then we hit like 4 cities with each tour. And again, like a book a year. So I'm not doing like some, at this point, like some like 25, you know, city tour. Wow. Jeff Kinney can do that. Like Jeff.
Well, what Jim is referencing is long ago, I joined Jeff on one of his early tours and he had a bus. He says, I'll meet you in the parking lot. I'm in the bus. And I said, how will I know the bus? And he says, you'll know it.
Yeah.
It's all liveried out with Diary of a Wimpy Kid stuff. And it was the bus. Its previous renter had been Pink when Pink went on tour. So God, it was an actual damn rock and roll bus. Yes. Now he's actually scaled down now. I think he goes around in like a large minivan.
He's got a van. He's got a van now. He does. And Jeff drives.
Yeah.
I was lucky enough 2 books ago. I think when they did a game show event. So for those playing at home, so Jeff Kinney, Diary of a Wimpy Kid, one of the most successful books in the history of literature. Seriously, you know, he's one of the, so Jeff can do as much or as little as he possibly wants, but he still likes going to the bookstores, and the book tours are almost exclusively going to schools. And in this case, he went and he does an event every time. One time went around with his own rock band. Brian, they're going to tell us what he did with you, but in this case, he was doing a game show. So he went to a school and they set up an entire effing game show. and I don't mean like a little cardboard this. I mean, like you go there, it's like the set of Jeopardy that they set up in a middle school in Palo Alto. And I was one of the guests. I'm competing against other kids while Jeff is the host. And anyway, we had a grand old time. And then we were done. We had I had to split, he had to split. And we both passed each other on the freeway. And Jeff is in the van with a bunch of his peeps and we're following, and like he's got like a Diary of a Wimpy Kid on the side. Like, it's not subtle. It's a big old Diary of a Wimpy Kid on the side of the van. It's the best. It's the best. Yep. So Brian, what craziness did he have you doing back in the day?
I forget the title of the book, but he brought a whole kind of carnival outfit with him. He had a fortune teller, he had a contortionist. Yeah, he had a whole crew of people who traveled with him.
The publishers must love him because he's like, I've been out with Homer Hickam when he does his October Sky thing, and he will not start a sentence without being, as I said in my book, and with every interview, and it's, you know, he's perfect on the marketing angle, but being able to have your own game show or carnival, that's solid for them. For
the you do a lot of school talks, and I know you're also you know, the ALA librarians, that kind of thing. Those are the best audiences.
Oh, forget about it. Oh, I mean, just so back in the day when my first Hilo book came out, Random House asked me, you know, do you like doing school visits? And I said, I've never done them. You know, I've usually done bookstores or whatnot, but I'm happy to do it. And you know, so I set up like a little presentation, which would be for kids, you know, which I'll run through my laptop. It's a keynote presentation with slides and some jokes and stuff. And I go to my first school, which was out here in the Bay Area, and I meet the librarian and we're walking in and she's walking me into the cafeteria. And it clicks in my brain. It's like, oh, am I doing an assembly? She goes, yeah, did you not know that? It's like, no, I just thought I was going to go to the classroom or the library. She goes, no, we're going to have the whole school here. It's like 400 kids. It's like, it's like, really? She's like, are you okay with that? It's like, am I okay with that? This is great. Yeah. No, I'm an attention hog. This is the best. And after that, like, I just reached back out to random. I was like, I don't want to go to bookstores anymore and like sweat it out on like a Tuesday night at 6 o'clock and wonder if anyone's going to show up. Forget about it. Send me to a school where there's 300 kids who are so happy. I mean, you're doing an assembly. So they're not in class for an hour. So their level of happiness is about an 8 out of 10 anyway, right? And what am I doing? Am I talking about fire safety or like from the Dairy Council, how milk is made or some crap? No, talking about like the same crap we've been talking about here. I'm talking about superheroes and cartoons. And so it's a blast. I highly recommend it to anybody. Get yourself to a middle school and do an assembly. You'll love it. It's a good time.
Wow.
Endorsed.
Yes.
Not as well. Indoors.
Oh, wow.
No, endorsed, I said. No,
endorsed.
Sorry.
Okay.
Indoors is good. Yeah.
No, I endorse the message.
I thought you were speaking in the original Norse for just a moment. So
no, that was last
down that
minute.
Road
that
with
was...
mythology and things. Yes, indeed.
Wow. Well, Judd, thanks so much for being on the show. I really, really appreciate having you here. And Brian likes to flex his comic book muscle, so you've helped him get some work out and talking about the mechanics of it.
Hey, truth is, Brian and I are just getting warmed up here. We could do another 35 minutes, easy. We didn't even name check any actual creators outside of I believe outside of Will Eisner, so it was like top of the pyramid. So we're just so thank you, gentlemen, for having me. It was an honor and a privilege.
Awesome. Wow. Well, I'd like to thank our audience for being with us. If you'd like to continue the conversation, we're always available at Camp Lehigh, the Captain America Minute listeners base on Facebook. If you do like our show, don't forget to subscribe and leave a like at the podcast streaming service where you found this episode. Also, please check out our website, capminute.com, for the latest about our podcast topics and guests. And be sure to join us here next time on the... You can join us on the October Sky Minute, but join us here next time on the Captain America Minute.
I can do this all day.